Greetings, greetings, fellow WhoGazers, and welcome to Doctor Who Literature, the new podcast taking you through the world of the Target novelizations in publication order. My name is Jason, and I'm your host on this journey, this very long journey. This is our third week on the Target line proper, where we'll be for well over 100 more planned episodes. This week, we're also joined for another guest interview, my good friend Mark from the Trap One podcast. We're discussing one of his favorite books today, and in the second half of the episode, we'll have a wide-ranging discussion about it and a few other tangential topics. It's March 1974 in the book line, still early days, when every book was a bumper volume. For the second release in a row, we're getting two books in a month, both long ones, both excellent ones. Up first, a 159-page Malcolm Hulk masterpiece, not to be mistaken for the 152-page Malcolm Hulk masterpiece we discussed last week when Stacy Smith was on as our guest interview. Let's get to it. Doctor Who and the Doomsday Weapon, televised as Colony in Space, written by Malcolm Hulk, from a teleplay by Malcolm Hulk, televised in April and May 1971, published in March 1974. So here we are, not only at the sixth Doctor Who novelization, but also at the sixth novelization to change the title of the story it's adapting. My biggest issue with this particular renaming is that I can never remember, between this and the Star Trek original series episode, which one is the Doomsday Weapon, and which one is the Doomsday Machine. Colony in Space is not a beloved story. The Discontinuity Guide from the mid-1990s, the text of which for a time was pressed into service as the BBC's official summary of the episode on its old website, likened it to watching socially aware paint dry. Doctor Who and the Doomsday Weapon, though, is a much more universally beloved novelization. This is the second straight book from Malcolm Hulk. Last week, I described how Hulk cheerfully junked these seven-part scripts for Doctor Who and the Silurians and told almost a brand new and much differently paced story in the novelization Doctor Who and the Cave Monsters. Hulk does almost exactly the same thing when adapting Colony in Space for print. He'll lavish the first half of the book on the first two TV episodes before rushing through the back four episodes in the second half of the book. On TV, episodes 1 and 2 were largely static material, long before the main villain, the Master, even shows up. In the book, though, the episodes 1 and 2 material are almost the raison d'etre for the whole book, and all the Master business, and indeed all the business about the Doomsday Weapon itself, are rushed through only in the final third. Episode 1 alone takes nearly 7 of the book's 21 chapters to adapt. As with his previous book, Hulk essentially dedicates one chapter to the viewpoint of a different character, or group of characters. For my money, each one of these first 7 chapters alone could serve as a remarkable short story. Chapter 1, A Missing Secret. This is the first novelization of a Master story, so Hulk has some scene setting to do. TV's episode 1 opened with a short scene on the as-yet-unnamed planet of the Time Lords. Hulk expands on this for the book with original characters, as the 2,000-year-old Keeper of the Files gives his very young, 573-year-old apprentice a quick update on Time Lord history, how the first TARDISes could only fit 3 to 4 people, how the Doctor and the Master both became escapee Time Lord renegades. We even get another Doctor Who joke years before Stephen Moffat. Suddenly, the old Keeper's failing energies returned. Still, even if he cannot control the TARDIS, others sometimes can. "I don't understand," said the young Time Lord. "What others? Who? Who? No, who can't control it? Not always." Hulk here employs the phrase chameleon-like to describe the TARDIS's theoretical shape-changing ability, which I believe is the first official use of the term, 7 years before we first heard Chameleon Circuit on TV. The Master is described as someone who never does anything good for anyone. He's thoroughly evil. There's also another recap of the War Games, as was done in one of the previous novelizations 2 months earlier, even though the War Games itself was about 5 years away from being adapted in print. Here, We learn that the Time Lords keep the Doomsday Weapon secreted on a distant planet, and that the Master has stolen their data file on the subject, leaving behind a sarcastic note best read in Roger Delgado's voice. Thank you for letting me know where to find the Doomsday Weapon. The Master. Chapter 2. Into Time and Space. Apart from the Master's debut, this is the first Joe Grant novelization. She'll also appear in this month's concurrent release, Doctor Who and the Day of the Daleks, which we'll discuss next week, but as her proper TV debut story, Terror of the Autons, would not be novelized for another year or so, Doomsday Weapon is chosen as the vehicle for her formal introduction to the books. Hulk thus gets to write a formal introduction scene for Joe, much as David Whittaker wrote a fictional introduction for Barbara and Ian back in the very first novelization. Joe is much less a buffoon in Hulk's hands than she was in her TV intro. Here, she's quite determined to be a spy, and while it's still said that her influential uncle got her the unit job, Hulk stands up for her quite a bit in the face of a series of patronizing older men. While she was still at school, she decided what she most wanted to do, to become a spy. One half term, she took herself to London and sought out her uncle, who worked as a senior civil servant for the government. "I want to be a spy," she said. He laughed, and sent out one of his many secretaries to buy her an ice cream. But Jo here is in fact competent, good at her studies, and wanting to be more than an embassy filing clerk. It's the doctor who's stubborn in refusing her services once she arrives at UNIT. When she follows him into the TARDIS, the Time Lords choose to use this moment to send the doctor off in search of the Master, with Jo along as an unwilling and disbelieving passenger. Here's how Hulk describes the TARDIS's dematerialization sound. Joe's ears were pierced by a terrifying sound, something like, yet not quite like, the trumpeting of 1,000 mad elephants. Vivid, if not quite as punchy as Dix's preferred wheezing groaning sound. Chapter 3. The Planet. Joe faints from the TARDIS's sudden departure, and the doctor wakens her by saying, "I'm sorry, but I don't remember your name." Hulk gives Joe a meta-joke about the decidedly terrestrial locations used to double as alien planets in 70s Who. The monitor screen showed a barren landscape, a treeless stretch of rock and occasional shrubs. Hulk writes, "It looks like somewhere in North Wales," she said. Joe continues to resist the fact that they're on another world, and in fact accuses the doctor of having hypnotized her. I'm not sure this is the best way of rendering Joe as a sympathetic audience identification figure, but it does allow Hulk to show the doctor persuading her to take a chance and explore this strange new world, giddy in his unexpected freedom from exile on Earth. But, as was also typical for 70s Who, the TARDIS crew are quickly captured at the point of a futuristic-looking shotgun. We meet Robert Ash, the leader of this colony in space, except in the book his given name is changed to John, and as a big white-haired man, he looks nothing like John Ringham, who played him on TV. This is also where Hulk brings us in on the storyline that dominated the early episodes of the TV serial, the clash between the idealistic colonists and the greedy industrial combine. The colonists are fleeing an overcrowded 30th century Earth, 500 years later than the TV story, but can't get any crops to grow, and are having problems with the native population of their new planet, named Uxarias, with the U in the script, unnamed on screen and in the novelization, and called Exarius with an E on the back cover blurb of the U.S. reprint. They're also terrified of the arrival of any company seeking to turn this planet into a strip mine slag heap, hence their initial suspicion of the Doctor and Joe. Chapter 4, The Monster. Hulk now shifts us to our third POV in four chapters, from the Time Lords to Joe Grant, and now to the Leesons, two of Ash's more idealistic colonists. Through the mind of Jane Leeson, Hulk gives us a riveting glimpse of life on Earth circa 2972. Earth is now covered, every square kilometer of land, replaced with concrete and housing towers, with no more fresh air, or grass, or trees. He writes, "By getting married, they qualified for a room of their own. Previously, she had had to share a room with her parents and three sisters. The marriage was conducted by a friendly computer that played music to them, as well as announcing that their state records had been stapled together in the great automatic state personnel file, which meant that they were then married. Then the computer gave them the key to their room, a cubicle just big enough for a double bed, a shower, and a lavatory. They took one look at the room and decided they had to escape. The 2 years that I lived in Manhattan's Upper East Side were much like this, by the way. We learn how the Leesons sought out ash, and how like-minded citizens pooled their resources and made it out to this planet for colonization. They did this in the face of, quote, the terrifying creatures space travelers had found over the centuries, monoids, Draavins, some small metallic creatures called Daleks. Hulk may have been pulling our leg by name-checking two of those alien races, but he also works in a footnoted plug for his previous book. And then, Jane Leeson and her husband are killed by some unseen beast, something infinitely more terrifying than she had ever imagined in her wildest dreams, Hulk writes. Then there's a full-page illustration of her covering her mouth in abject fright, but not in the Pinnacle edition, which I have. Chapter 5. Starvation. Here, it's a conversation between Ash and the Doctor about colony life and about the primitives, a six-fingered race of devolved and naked humanoids with whom they share the planet. Hulk goes into much more detail about these creatures than the corresponding episode 1 did on television. We learn of the primitives' irrational fear of dolls, which will pay off later, and which adds still more complexity, which the TV episodes lacked. On TV, the primitives were introduced only just before the cliffhanger, and were established as having already killed two colonists, a jarring detail, which Hulk dropped for the book. Through the Doctor's eyes, we also learn more about these strange humans of 2972, also devolved in their own way. The Doctor recalls all the Earth animals had been systematically exterminated by mankind by the year 2500. But the colonist's tale gets more poignant yet. Chapter 6, The Survivor. Another POV switch, as we hear about the colony's woes from inside Ash's head. Establishing Ash as a POV character will also pay off in a big way once the book gets to the episodes 5 and 6 material. It's here, where we learn that none of the humans remember how to hold a funeral, and it's the Doctor, not even human himself, who has to reintroduce the custom to these refugees from mankind, who've even forgotten the word graves. In burying the Leesons, we also learn a startling fact about the year 2972. Now we have a service, said the Doctor. What religion were they? Religion? Said Ash, not understanding. This sequence, with the Doctor reminding mankind of something they've forgotten, is pretty much unique among all the novelizations. If only some of the endless capture-escape-capture loops that dominated the story on TV had been replaced with character-driven material like this, the TV serial would have a much better reputation. Chapter 7, The Robot. Now the Doctor instructs Ash on the importance of remembering man's survival instinct. How do you think man first made out on Earth? Asked the Doctor. He had to fight saber-toothed tigers, rampaging mammoths, diseases of all sorts. He survived. To that end, the Doctor visits the Leeson's wrecked dome to solve a puzzling mystery, how a monster, reported to be 20 feet high, could enter a dome with a 6-foot-high door. The TV script predated the UK conversion to the metric system. Writing in 1974, Hulk now has the colonists thinking in metric, and it's the Doctor who converts us back into feet and inches. We meet our first primitives, who here are mentioned to be telepathic, and who scavenge items from the wrecked dome. We also learn of the Doctor's capacious pockets. From this point on, the word capacious becomes kind of a signature word for the rest of the target line. And then, the cliffhanger happens. Except, again, Hulk hides it in mid-chapter, in mid-paragraph, in mid-sentence even. I wish he'd stop doing that. It made it real difficult for 1980s me to mark off the cliffhanger moment in the text.
What do you think you're up to?
Hey! These are your crop records, I take it.
That's right, but I really don't see what it has to do with you.
It's a very poor showing, isn't it? Are you operating above subsistence level?
We're surviving, come on!
No, just a minute. I'd like to hear what he has to say.
Unless I'm very much mistaken, you've got far more to worry about than mineralogists.
Just what do you mean by that?
Unless things improve radically, you're in grave danger of starving to death.
Reading the episode 2 material on the novelization of Colony in Space, right after watching episode 2 on the DVD, with the text commentary enabled, is an interesting experience. It's also a profoundly geeky one, but if you subscribe to this podcast, geekiness shouldn't be much of a surprise to you already. But the point is that the DVD text commentary compares the on-screen product to Hulk's original scripts, so you can see what bits of dialogue and action were changed or cut for air. And all those deleted scripted bits wind up right back in the novelization. This makes Hulk's novelization unique in two respects. One, he's describing what he wanted to see in the story, as opposed to what changes the director, Michael Bryant, and the actors worked out in rehearsal, or what lines of dialogue got trimmed for timing reasons. Two, he's adding a liberal, and I choose that word with precision, dose of character flourishes and motivation, on top of merely describing the action. In discussing the episode 1 material and the novelization, we talked about how Hulk used a mosaic of different viewpoints to show us life on the planet Axarius among the colonists. But now, in reading the episode 2 material, we see Hulk bring the same perspective to the villains, and that flips the book on its head. Chapter 7, continued. Caldwell is described in the script, according to the DVD text commentary, as a tough, hard-bitten man in his late 30s. That exact phrase turns up in the novelization. The IMC servo robot, which serves as the cliffhanger menace for both episodes 1 and 2 on TV, was scripted as humanoid and appears as such in the book as well, rather than an enormous box. Hulk tells us the robot came walking out of the dome in this chapter, and then a few pages later we see it carefully dismounting from the buggy as it lumbered across towards the doctor, rather than as the war machine type thing we saw on television. Hulk also gives the robot a head and mouth, and shows that it can even repeat human speech. This creepy, walking, laughing IMC robot clearly was much diminished in translation on television. Chapter 8, The Men from IMC. This is the chapter where Hulk reveals Captain Dent and promptly allows the new bad guy to drive the narrative. Dent, the IMC ship captain, was played on TV by actor Morris Perry, wearing a rather wavy, glam, blonde wig, but without much backstory or motivation. But because Hulk has expanded the first two episodes of the story to take up just about half the novelization on its own, there's room now for Dent's whole history. Hulk writes, "He was always reminded of the power of the Interplanetary Mining Corporation and his place within that organization. When he was a child, his father had told him, 'You've got to work hard at school and at university, and then you must get into one of the big corporations and stay there, and they'll look after you.' He had listened to his father's advice. He had never wanted to be like his uncle, a man who had changed jobs many times in his life and still had no real position in the world. From the beginning, Dent wanted to work up to a good job, and that meant getting into a really big corporation and staying there. He was lucky enough to join IMC at the age of 20, one of 5 successful applications that term, out of 17,000. Immediately, he got a room of his own to live in, a rare privilege for any unmarried man on the overcrowded planet Earth. He was given 6 months training on a spaceship maintenance. He studied day and night, and never took the elevator up to the sunshine, or went for walks or attended parties. He graduated with honors." One could extrapolate enough to write a 500-page textbook on the history of IMC, based solely on the glimpses and insights that Hulk gives us here. We learn that IMC prefers its officers to be married, and prefers to select those officers' brides via computerized matching programs. Tinder in space? Hulk writes, "His wife was waiting for him, quite a pretty young woman with short hair dyed dull blue, as was the fashion that month. 'Are you my husband?' she said, as he let himself in. 'I imagine I will be,' he answered, looking around his new home. It had 2 rooms, a shower, a lavatory, and a tiny kitchen. He was amazed at the influence wielded by IMC, which could get him anywhere to live in as big as this. He asked, 'Do you know how much all this is going to cost me?' 'I worked it out,' said the girl. 'Even if they make you up to captain in a year, with your earnings, you'll pay off IMC for all this in about 20 years' time. But of course, by then we'll have moved to somewhere bigger, and they'll be children. So I imagine you'll be paying back IMC for just about the rest of your life.'" There's a lovely paragraph that follows, in which Dent mentally uses the acronym IMC 7 times in 2 sentences. In late 1960s, early 70s term, Dent is the establishment, capital E, and even expressly likens the colonists to hippies, saying they're dropouts from society. Of course, Dent says this as if it's a bad thing, but we already know that Hulk clearly sympathizes more with the colonists. And when Dent ironically observes that he can't shoot the colonists because Earth government is supposed to care for all its people, you realize that the keen relevance of the script is not limited to 1971. On the other hand, there's one bit of mental advice from Captain Dent that served me well in my law practice days. Hulk writes, "During arguments, people exposed what was really going on in their minds, and Dent never wanted other people to know what he was thinking." We learn a lot about Dent's internal thought processes, philosophies of management, and his ability to present himself as a, quote, simple, non-scientific man, to dodge debate points, all as he verbally fences with the Doctor in this chapter. Hulk writes, "Normally, he didn't have to contend with intelligent people like the Doctor." You might not have Morris Perry high up on your personal all-time Doctor Who human villains pantheon, but book Captain Dent should surely qualify. And this chapter's just about as good as it gets. Chapter 9, The Spy. Hulk now shifts POV to another IMC villain, but this time a very different one, Norton the Spy. Norton's an IMC plant, sent to the colony pretending to be the sole survivor of a distant colony on the same planet. A colony massacred, so he says, by primitives and enormous reptiles. On TV up to this point, we learn in episode 2 that Norton's a ruthless killer. He won't be outed as an IMC spy until later. But Hulk spells out his loyalties for us right away. Norton is another dedicated and efficient IMC man, but for very different reasons than Dent. In his heart, the book says, he had wanted to become an actor, but his father and mother told him that he ought to get work with one of the big corporations. Now he had the comfort and security of working for one of the biggest, IMC, and he had the chance to do some very real-life acting. There's also the novelization line's rare acknowledgement of the human sexual urge, as Norton feigns interest in Ash's daughter, in order to secure some time away from the men. Later in the chapter, as Norton prepares to brutally murder a colonist and a primitive, in order to persuade the colonists to leave the planet, he likens his preparation to an actor waiting to go on stage, waiting for his cue. The only thing lacking was an audience, but in the circumstances that was perhaps as well. End quote. Hulk extends the acting metaphor throughout the chapter. While Dent's an efficient, bloodless corporate killer, Norton is another sort of killer, a cheerful sociopath. Norton parted two of the fingers covering his eyes in order to watch Ash as he stood over Holden's body. He congratulated himself on a marvelous performance. Brr. Chapter 10, The Claw. Back to the Doctor's POV, as he puzzles over the IMC in-flight entertainment system and can't decide whether the music, a low thumping sound and occasional groans, is meant to be classical or pop. He is then taken by IMC First Officer Morgan back to the Leeson's wrecked dome. It's a trap that Dent has sent to have the Doctor killed by the IMC robot, and to have the death blamed on the hostile local lizards. Hostile as told in the book, that is. On TV, the role of the holographic projection of a hostile lizard was played by footage of a placid gecko. Hulk milks dry humor by revealing that the Doctor knows Morgan is leading him into a trap, and feels that the man was, quote, just too pathetic to play with anymore. As Morgan springs the trap, episode 2 ends, and Hulk again buries the cliffhanger in mid-sentence. After the break, Malcolm Hulk performs a total paddingectomy of the final four episodes of Colony in Space, and we'll learn how the best parts of the book didn't come from the TV production.
Right, well, I have now heard the statements from both sides. I think you should know that on my way here, I contacted Earth and had a check made of planetary records. Now, obviously, an error has occurred. A faulty computer on Earth has allocated this planet both for colonization and for mineralogical exploitation. It will therefore be my duty to judge this case upon its merits.
It's the Master!
Since, however, the issues are extremely complicated, I shall need time to consider my decision. This tribunal stands adjourned.
why are you impersonating the adjudicator?
My dear Doctor, I am the adjudicator.
Rubbish.
What are you doing here anyway? Did the Time Lord send you?
Nobody sends me anywhere. I'm a free agent.
So you've at last succeeded in escaping from your long exile on Earth. Congratulations. What are your plans now?
Well, my immediate plans are to expose you as an imposter.
That would be very foolish of you. My credentials are immaculate.
Forged, of course.
Of course, but immaculate. May I see your credentials, Doctor?
Don't be absurd.
What? No interplanetary travel permit? No registration for your TARDIS? No personal identification?
After spending almost half the novelization on just the first two episodes of Colony in Space, Malcolm Hulk then rushes through the final four episodes in the second half of the book. As much as I love Hulk the TV scriptwriter, and as much as I defend those who call Colony in Space as boring as watching socially aware paint dry, Hulk does improve on the televised material in the print version. The Doctor Who production team in those days, for budgetary reasons, was obligated to give us several six-part stories a year. Hulk was one of the best writers in their stable, in terms of both quality of writing and speed of drafting, and he knew how to pad out those six-part stories. There are lots of capture-escape-capture loops in Colony in Space, and long two-character dialogue scenes spread out over half of episodes. It takes skill to pad like that. As with the final episodes in the novelization of Doctor Who and the Silurians, episodes 5 and 6 of Doomsday Weapon are pared down drastically. Capture-escape-capture loops are simplified, and those two-handed dialogue scenes are condensed and sharpened. Although we do lose the magic trick that John Pertwee plays on Pat Gorman's primitive in episode 4. Terrence Dix would have kept that in had he written the book. But that doesn't mean the TV script is left in tatters. The TV episode 3, surprisingly for a story of this one's reputation, is rather fast cut. Turns out that a lot of script action and dialogue had to be trimmed to get that episode to fit into 25 minutes, and Hulk reinstates the trimmed material for the book. We're told more about Joe and Winton's foray into the IMC ship, their being chained to a bomb, and their escape. The book gives Joe more credit for the escape. On TV, it's her and Winton equally, but in the book, it's pretty much all Joe. The book also makes more of Norton's subtle episode 3 villainy in turning the colonists against the Doctor. Makes more of Caldwell's decision to rebel against Captain Dent in lobbying for Joe's release from captivity, revealing that IMC can't control him anymore because his IMC-selected wife has already left him, and more of the hot-tempered Winton's power struggle against the more sedate and reasoned Ash. Winton does lead an assault on the IMC ship late in episode 3, aided by the Doctor. But in the book, the Doctor has to earn Winton's trust before he's allowed to join, by quoting General Patton, prefacing his speech with the amusing clause, "Back in the days when Earth had wars." If only. There's an extra character, the colonist named Smedley, who doesn't appear on TV. Smedley partially replaces the role of Alec Leeson, brother of the Leeson murdered earlier in the story, in episode 4. In the book, it's Smedley who gets to kill the IMC spy Norton, which isn't what happened on TV. And Smedley survives the book, unlike Alec Leeson. However, there's one major omission from the episode 3 material in the novelization, the cliffhanger itself. We've talked about how Hulk buries many cliffhangers in mid-chapter, or mid-sentence, as often happens in this book. But the episode 3 cliffhanger, Joe being brought into the Primitive's cave system, is so mild that Hulk just deletes it entirely for the book. Thankfully, Joe's solo scenes in the first half of episode 4, including her nonsensical scream at the sight of a primitive priest, are also gone. This was her fourth televised story. There's no need for her to scream at weird-looking aliens, not after she just survived the claws of Axos. Episodes 4 through 6 are dominated by the target debut of the Master, whose presence was teased in the first two chapters. Because Hulk condenses those three episodes into the back third of the book, there's not as much Master in the book as one might have hoped, but Hulk does him justice while he's there. Director Michael Bryant quickly revealed, 6 minutes into episode 4 on TV, that the Adjudicator is actually the Master in disguise. According to the DVD text commentary, Hulk intended for Roger Delgado's face to be obscured for much of the episode, but Bryant felt differently. Hulk keeps up the pretense longer, but the first description of the Adjudicator is also our first look at the Master in a target novelization, even if we don't know it's him yet. Hulk says, "The adjudicator was already sitting there, smart in his black tunic and trousers, a small dark beard accentuating the thrust of his chin, and compelling brown eyes which darted from one to another of the colonists and IMC men as they trooped in." Later, the adjudicator pulled on his little beard, which is a nice little Roger Delgadoism. There's also a clever character beat where Captain Dent demands the adjudicator show his identity papers, only to be rebuffed. Hulk also describes the adjudicator's sham tribunal with glee, including the master's quick wit from the bench and cutting down Ash's endless objections. Hulk holds the reveal back a bit longer, ending Chapter 14, The Adjudicator, with Captain Dent's ambiguous realization. There was something very strange about this adjudicator. In Chapter 15, Primitive City, Hulk describes the primitives as strange half-men, and the Doctor tries to buy back Joe from captivity with, as he terms them, exciting and interesting bits of machinery, which is quite a step down from the food that he offered them on TV. Hulk's primitives are fascinated by bits of metal. Hulk replaces Joe's scream at the primitive priest with this more clever dialogue exchange. "It's got a horrible face, like an animal." "It might have a horrible face to you," said the Doctor, "but to itself it might be rather good-looking." "You haven't seen it," she said. The primitive's interest in dolls, a plot point dropped from TV but established in the Episode 1 material in the book, pays off when the Doctor notes strange doll-like figures present on wall murals in the primitive city. As originally intended by Hulk, in an effect that had to be dialed down considerably in studio in 1971, the primitive's leader, their guardian, is described as a small doll-like creature who seemed to swim up from the flames. Here, the Guardian threatens to sacrifice Joe because it amuses the primitives. Then the Doctor gets to argue for her life, in a way that he didn't need to on TV, by asking, "Does the amusement of your servants warrant the death of an intelligent being?" The Guardian speaks in logical puzzles, questioning the Doctor's defense of life, by noting that the process of eating, even by vegetarians, involves the consumption of some form of life. The Doctor rebuts the point, "All nature kills to eat. But that is for the purpose of continuing life in another form. To throw this girl into those flames would be to extinguish life, totally." That logic wins the day, and the Doctor and Joe are allowed to leave the primitive city. When they return to the colonists' dome, the colonists have lost their hearing, and Winton's faction of colonists quickly declares independence from Earth. This leads to another sharp exchange, much better than the mostly functional TV dialogue. Joe appealed to the Doctor, "You must stop them, Doctor. They'll be outlaws." "I know," said the Doctor. "But how can I say anything when I really agree with them?" At the Episode 4 cliffhanger, Hulk gives the Master a more villainous line. "I'd rather be watching your face as I pull the trigger," he says, though the cliffhanger moment itself is again placed in mid-paragraph. Episode 5 in the book removes several capture-escape-capture loops, though it's a shame to lose a fiery dialogue scene between secondary cast members Mary Ash and IMC man Caldwell, as the former berates the latter for sending all the colonists out into space in an obsolete spaceship not fit for blastoff. On TV, the real adjudicator's identity is portrayed by a photo of what is believed to be regular Who director Douglas Camfield, as per the DVD commentary track. In the book, though, Hulk envisions the original adjudicator as a round, chubby man whose eyes were blue, with fair hair, and there was no beard. Not exactly Douglas Camfield. The Doctor here speculates on the real adjudicator's fate, which he didn't do on TV. Poor Martin Jurgen, whoever he was, probably floating for all eternity in space, or atomized, he says. After the IMC men are temporarily defeated in Episode 5, separate and apart from their other temporary defeats in Episodes 3 and 4, Dent noticed how Morgan had stopped calling him Sir since things had gone against them. Morgan remembers to add the Sir after the IMC men regain the colony. Late in the Episode 5 material, Hulk gives us a remarkable scene with John Ash, which has no parallel on TV. Earlier in the book, we learn that the colonists had no idea how to arrange a funeral and did not recognize the word religion. But here, we see that of the two books Ash has brought with him in space, one is the Christian Bible, something written thousands of years ago. It was largely about someone called God. It was this second book he now tried to read, not because he really understood it, but because the strange language fascinated him. It contained four versions of a story about a man who sacrificed his own life for the sake of others. It was this part of the book that most interested Ash, because it was so difficult to understand. Why, he asked himself, should anyone willingly give his own life for other people? I read this novelization in 1985, a few years before I finally read the Christian Bible for school. When I read the latter, I was reminded of this paragraph. It foreshadows Ash's noble self-sacrifice in episode 6 on TV, and gives context to that decision. The noble self-sacrifice of a secondary character to resolve the plot is an old Who staple, but Hulk puts a new spin on it. More Ash angst comes after Winton deposes him as colony leader, and then the IMC men re-reconquer the colony. Hulk writes, Dent held a handgun on Ash's head, and Morgan went to the door and called to the colonists, Stop firing or we kill Ash. The firing continued, and Ash wondered if none of the colonists now cared whether he lived or died. At the same time, Hulk has Dent briefly contemplate the cold-blooded murder of a colonist who'd hit him several chapters previously. Morris Perry may not be the best remembered human villain in the Who pantheon, but Captain Dent, in the novelization, sure should be. Episode 6 is a double act between the Doctor and Master, mortal enemies trapped together in the primitive city, and acting as pseudo-companions to one another. Consider carefully, Doctor, the Master says on TV, as he tries to use the Doomsday Weapon to lure the Doctor into a partnership. I'm offering you a half-share in the universe. You'll never understand, will you? Replies the Doctor. I want to see the universe, not rule it. These scenes are problematic on TV because of the chemistry that Delgado and Pertwee had. There was always an element of friendship bubbling up under their most adversarial moments. This is a wonderful problem to have, by the way. In the book, Hulk is free to alter that chemistry by making the Master more bloodthirsty and clearly inferior to the Doctor. The Doctor gives a quick lesson in telepathy and is able to induce two primitives to abandon their post guarding the Doomsday Weapons control room. And as the Doctor won a logical debate with the Guardian in the Episode 4 material, the Master now loses one in Episode 6. Don't listen to such rubbish, said the Master. You can continue to live, and I shall protect you. With the Doomsday Weapon, I shall protect all the universe. Against what, said the Guardian, will you protect the universe? The question took the Master off balance. Well, he said, against anyone who tries to attack it. But the universe is all matter and space, said the Guardian. So what can attack that, which is everything? I shall protect it against itself, said the Master, desperately wishing to get out of this discussion. Of course, the Master still gets to have witty thoughts. Doctor, said the Master, somewhat hurt, have you ever known me to be vindictive? He continued before the Doctor had time to answer, says Hulk. We also get to see more of the primitives' worship of the Doomsday Weapon, as they feed it radioactive isotopes in a religious ritual that has lost all scientific meaning for them. It's merely a tattered remnant of their lost knowledge of nuclear power. The IMC crewman, who guards the colonists' ship in Episode 6, Rogers, played on TV by Pertwee stunt double Terry Walsh, volunteers for the assignment because he wants a promotion and bigger living quarters. His dreams are, of course, soon tragically shattered, without the long, wet clay fight scene that Walsh lost as a stuntman on TV. Caldwell's defection to the colonists also has more meaning, because where on TV the colonists send for a new adjudicator after defeating IMC for the last time, here the colonists form an independent republic. This makes Caldwell's choice more risky and dramatic. Hulk does steal one bit of dialogue. After Ash's noble self-sacrifice, Winton observes that he might have been a little crazy, but the Doctor suggests that perhaps he was a saint. This line is adapted from The Mind of Evil, not a Hulk TV script, made two serials before this one. The last chapter of the book is far more majestic than on TV. There's another funeral for all the victims of the final colonists/IMC shootout. And this time the colony remembers enough of the ritual to not need the Doctor's help. And then the planet begins to flower and bud in a way that couldn't have been realized on location. In the end, Joe emerges from the book a smarter character, making this a satisfying debut novel for her. When the TARDIS arrives back at Unit HQ on the last page, only minutes after they left from his point of view, the Brigadier asks her if she's lost her sense of time. On the contrary, she said with a smile. I think I'm just beginning to gain it. Next time, Joe Grant returns in Doctor Who and the Day of the Daleks, not nearly as satisfying a story for her as the Doomsday Weapon. Here's the back cover blurb on my copy of the Doomsday Weapon. Terrorizer of the Universe. While Doctor Who was exiled on Earth and restricted to the 20th century, the charming but hypnotically evil master, whose one ambition is to destroy Doctor Who, walked off with the Doomsday Weapon file. Doctor Who, commanded by the Time Lords to stop the master at any cost, is directed to a bleak planet in the year 2471. Hidden somewhere on that planet is the Doomsday Machine, lurking somewhere in that time zone is the master. Will Doctor Who, hampered by alien monsters, locate and dismantle the Doomsday Weapon before the master triggers it? It's a terrifying countdown affecting all mankind, past, present, and forever. Now, if you've never heard that back cover blurb before, you're not alone. What I'm reading from is not the Target book. This is one of seven Doctor Who novelizations that I do not own as a Target. This is, in fact, a Pinnacle edition. Pinnacle was, and I believe still is, a U.S. publisher that acquired the rights to 10 Doctor Who titles, ranging from Day of the Daleks, number 1, to The Seeds of Doom, number 10, that were published in a U.S. format with standardized spelling, U.S. rather than British quotation marks, and a bespoke new Doctor Who logo, which never appeared on television or in any of the Target books. My copy is known as the fifth printing. If the first printing of Doomsday Weapon is April 1979, the fifth printing is November 1984. That's five printings in 5.5 years. That'll do well for you. That's quite a lot of copies of this book out there, and Pinnacle was known for changing the color of the logo with each printing. So my copy of the Doomsday Weapon has the bespoke Doctor Who logo in red, outlined in white, against a black cover, with number 2 in the right-hand corner of the book. The cover illustration is fascinating, and I've put it in the show notes for this podcast release on Anchor. It was painted by an American biker artist named David Mann, and it doesn't bear any resemblance to the TV episode. The Guardian is an angelic figure in yellow with a babyish face, and his fingers of his hand trail off into flames. On either side is half of a face, one of which is believed to be the master, and I'm not quite sure who the other is. But the face of the Guardian is framed by rat fangs, and there are lizard claws wrapped around the cover art. And just under the word weapon in the title is a primitive, looking nothing like the primitives that we saw on television, but more of a Native American-looking figure, bare-chested, with regular skin, not wearing any makeup or pajamas as on television, and with six fingers on his hand holding a spear. The back cover blurb is brand new and is, as you heard me read it, pretty hilarious. Pinnacle also added explanatory text. So the first page is an excerpt from one of the chapters, and it's titled Doctor Who Season 2 Our Future. When Doctor Who travels through time and space, and by the way, the editor charmingly capitalizes time and space, in search of the Doomsday Weapon, which is also capitalized, he lands on a strange planet and discovers a young lady thinking about her life on Earth during her past and during our future. There's then three paragraphs told from Jane Leeson's point of view, and then the editor adds another paragraph in italics. Such was life on Earth. But that seemed like eons in the past. Another life, another planet. Now Jane had to look forward to a new and different existence on an alien planet, a planet where they were being attacked by flesh-eating monsters, in the year 2471 of all things. Although the text of the book clearly says this takes place in 2972, so maybe the editor didn't read very carefully. The next page is a half-page description of the master, and then a half-page description of Joe Grant, which is unfortunate. Joe is Doctor Who's assistant, and has accompanied him on several trips through time and space in the TARDIS, the incredible flying police call box. While quite petite and very pretty, she's also smart, and is infuriated when Doctor Who treats her like a babbling idiot, which he often does. I think that's a compliment. On the next page is a list of the 10 available titles. I have 7 of these as Pinnacles. And then the publisher's logo is Pinnacle Books in New York. At the time, they were based near Bryant Park, near 42nd Street and 6th Avenue, which is pretty good real estate. I believe Pinnacle Books now has another name and is no longer located in that part of Manhattan. The front then continues with the, well, I want to say famous 6-page introduction by Harlan Ellison, which I understand he later denied having written, but it's unmistakably him. I will probably spend more time talking about the Harlan Ellison introduction, either in a bonus episode or a little bit later on. At the back of the book is a 3-page ad for the Richard Blade series, the continuing saga of a modern man's exploits in the hitherto uncharted realm of worlds beyond our knowledge. This is a very thinly veiled James Bond parody, and I hope to talk a little more about the Blade books at a later date. And now, it is time for us to be joined by another special guest. And I'm thrilled to be joined now by the godfather of the Doctor Who Literature Podcast, Mark, the founder and head honcho of the Trap One Podcast. Mark, welcome to the show, and thanks for coming on.
Thank you very much. It's an honor and a pleasure to be here.
What is the origin of the Trap One Podcast? I know you recently celebrated your 200th episode. How did y'all get started?
So, yeah, it started off, started blogging in 2012. Around the time, it would have been season 7A. I was really taken with Asylum of the Daleks. I really loved that story and just thought it'd be good to get some thoughts down on it and maybe start a bit of a discussion. So I started blogging then. And then about 5 years later, just trying to think of an idea for a podcast for a while, really, because I'm a big fan of a lot of Doctor Who podcasts. And I thought I need to find somebody to podcast with and I need to think of an idea. And then I just thought, actually, it'd be better if I just picked somebody different every week, and then it's not too much of a drain on any one person's time. And we can just talk about whatever's happening in Doctor Who, whether it's new episodes or books being released or Big Finish audios or just whatever's happening at the time. And yeah, now that's like another 5 years on. So it'll be 5 years in January since we started the podcast as well.
That's how I first found you, because I had my blog, Doctor Who Novels. That started, I launched that in 2011, but I didn't really start posting regularly until 2013, which was the first time that I was doing my pilgrimage through the classic series during the 50th anniversary year. So you and I would comment sporadically on each other's posts. And I know you first reached out to me in early 2017 when the podcast was getting started. So I know the first episode that I did was the new series adventure Diamond Dogs by Mike Tucker.
Yes.
And that was one of my very first podcast appearances ever. So I kind of dread to go back and listen to that now, almost 5 years on, to see how terrible I sounded.
Yeah, I've not gone back and listened to any of my early stuff. Sometimes people message you and say, oh, I'm going to do a deep dive and start your podcast from the beginning. I think, no, just listen to the recent stuff because I feel like I'm much more comfortable with it now. And I think it probably everybody's going to start a bit more stilted and less natural. I think you get accustomed to it after a while, don't you?
I'm still obviously trying to find my voice. This is pretty much episode 6 for this podcast, but I definitely have found my voice hosting several of the recent Trap Ones, which has been tremendous fun. And as the panel expands to 3 or 4 guests, sometimes it's quite a bit of an effort to keep everybody steered in the same direction. But we definitely had a raucous time covering In Your Absence some of the Flux episodes.
Yeah, they were great. They were great episodes. Yeah, and I think you got Joe and Simon as well. So bit of an unruly class to.
Joe and Simon will both be on this show coming up in the near future. Separately though, because together they are like the Marx Brothers. They are agents of chaos. Then no matter how tightly you script or plot an episode, if you have those two guys in the same room, say goodbye to your script and just get ready to embrace the spontaneity. You never know what those two guys are going to do next. So what does the future hold for the Trap One podcast? I know that you recently had a reformat.
Yeah, so now it's better for listeners that you don't just hear my voice on every episode, that we've now got a panel of which so you are a founding member. So we're going to have a combination of hosts and guests on each episode. So obviously, as we move into 2022, there's only going to be three episodes of Doctor Who to cover. But fortunately, there will be the Blu-ray releases. There'll be books coming out. There'll be vinyls and some kind of, hopefully some kind of just discussion podcasts as well. You know, we'll come up with a topic, like we've done a few like that, and look at different things and put a panel together like that.
Well, thanks very much for making me part of the Trap One universe, and I'm glad to have dragged you now into my little spin-off universe. So, Mark, what book are we here to discuss today?
We're going to talk about Doctor Who and the Doomsday Weapon by Malcolm Hulk. I've got my 1979 copy here that I've had since I was a kid. Not quite since 1979. Because I was only born in 1979, but probably purchased at some point in the 90s, I think.
That book wasn't a nursery gift for you in 1979? It wasn't a book for you to read at 6 months old?
Unfortunately not, no. It was very, very remiss of my parents, I think, not to be reading that to me as a toddler.
I was 5 months old when the original book came out, but naturally, of course, I was many years away from discovering Doctor Who secondhand in the States. So you're showing me the 1979 reprint with that amazing Roger Delgado cover. I've got the late 70s/early 80s US reprint under Pinnacle Books with their own bespoke logo and just absolutely bonkers cover art by David Mann, who was better known as an artist in the biker community. So you've got half of Roger Delgado's face on the cover. And the other half, I think that's meant to be John Pertwee with a mustache, but I'm not quite sure. There's been debate as to who exactly that is supposed to be.
Could be the Brigadier, actually.
Which wouldn't make much sense because he's only in about two pages of the book. But, of course, this is the same guy who painted the UNIT spaceship on the Day of the Daleks cover for a different Pinnacle book. So screen realism was not necessarily the goal of the Pinnacle books.
That is a striking cover, though. That's very good.
So, for your purposes, you know, there's like 158 target books, not counting the newer books that have been tied to the new series. How high up is Doomsday Weapon on the list for you of the great novelizations?
I think it's pretty high up. It's a long time since I've read most of them, but this one really stuck in my mind. And there's a few reasons why, I think, but one of them is that opening section with the Time Lords. I think probably when I was a kid and I hadn't seen a lot of the TV episodes beyond season 25 and 26. So I'd never seen, you know, other than the Master, I'd never seen Gallifrey or any other Time Lords or anything like that. So that scene that gives you a glimpse into Time Lord society and meeting just sort of normal Time Lords just going about their jobs on Gallifrey, That really stuck with me as a kid, as to what it's like. I think generally the world building in this book is excellent. Sort of both of Gallifrey, a future Earth, which we see through sort of flashbacks and backstories, and the planet that they've colonized. All three worlds are really, really well realized in the book.
I remember being disappointed when I finally saw the TV version, Colony in Space. Now that opening Time Lord scene is just so small and cursory and flat, because the detail he gives here in that first chapter, where it's the old Time Lord talking to the young Time Lord, and the old Time Lord ties himself back into the War Games, which of course Hulk co-wrote for TV but hadn't been novelized at the time. And I love the detail that he traveled in a TARDIS that was disguised as a machine gun post, and of course the younger Time Lord has no idea what that is.
Yeah, it's just fantastic, isn't it? This is the keeper of the Time Lord's files. And he's sort of training up his replacement, who is a much younger Time Lord, but he's still obviously like hundreds of years old or something, I think. But he's just a whippersnapper in terms of Time Lord age, because I think the outgoing keeper's about 2,000 years old or something. And it's a great sort of glimpse into their job. I love the way this really old Time Lord, he's got such nice memories of the end of the War Games. Like, it's the only time he's left Gallifrey, and he got to go out in a TARDIS, and, you know, he's got all these memories of this great big rescue mission where they took all the humans back to their respective times and places on Earth. His TARDIS was a machine gun turret, like you say, and all this sort of stuff. That's great. And it's just a really effective and efficient way of setting up time travel, TARDISes, the Doctor and the Master, because he also starts to tell the story about how two TARDISes have been stolen, one by the Doctor, one by the Master. So there's very much, as I'm sure we'll talk about, an eye on people reading this book who are not familiar with Doctor Who in terms of how it's introduced. So that's, I thought it was a great way of setting that up.
And Hulk is kind of lucky here, because obviously the first three books were reprints of the Frederick Muller books from the 1960s. And then the first two Target books proper had only come out 2 months earlier. This was March 1974. 2 months earlier, Dix had written the novelization of Spearhead from Space, and Hulk had written the novelization of Silurians. Those were both Liz Shaw books. And then, of course, it's another decade before we get Liz Shaw's other stories novelized. This is the first book that gets to introduce the Roger Delgado Master, who's represented on both of our covers, and the first book to introduce Joe Grant. And as I've already talked about in the main body of this episode, where I broke down the prose style of the book, this gives Joe a whole new introduction, because Terror of the Autons had not come out yet, and in fact wouldn't come out for a little bit longer. So this is the book that gets to formally introduce Joe, and Hulk gets to create a whole new backstory for her. How do you like the way that Hulk introduces Joe versus the way that it was actually done by Robert Holmes on TV in the original TV serial?
I like having them both. I like this is a much slower introduction to the world of the Doctor for Joe, because we hear about her uncle, don't we, on the TV episodes, but in this you get a longer timeline of her history. So she decides on a whim she wants to be a spy. So her uncle sends her on a sort of a training course, and then she's going to be posted, I think, to an embassy in Bangkok, where she'll just be just interpreting data about a sort of manufacturing of crops and things. And she goes, that's not what being a spy is all about. I want something different. So her uncle gets her in a unit with the Brigadier, sort of pulls some strings. And then she just hangs around the place, just bored out of her mind for days and days and days, because there's nothing going on. The Doctor's basically just ignoring her while he tries to fix the TARDIS. The Brigadier doesn't speak to her again until this the morning that this starts. She's on her way into work, and she decides, right, I'm just going to tell them that they either need to give me something to do or I'm resigning. I like that idea, because that does sort of ring true as well. It's obviously got to be much more truncated in a TV story, that she gets to know the Doctor very quickly and then embroiled in an adventure. But it does feel like the Pertwee Doctor would just have somebody around as well that he just wouldn't engage with until he needed to.
You compare that to part one of Terror of the Autons, where she comes on board, destroys the Doctor's experiment. Pertwee is horrifically rude to her, calls her a ham-fisted bun vendor, which is now the name of one of the Joe Ford podcasts. Ha ha. And then she gets hypnotized by the Master and tries to blow up Unit HQ with a bomb all in her first 24 minutes. I think she's a lot more competent in Doomsday Weapon. But I think Hulk is more favorably disposed towards her than Robert Holmes was, for sure.
Definitely, yeah. And she gets that really great scene later on where she escapes the handcuffs, and it's she's like, there's some grease from where the handcuffs have been in the packing case, and she's able to escape. And yeah, she's very resourceful in this. It's, and also the way she just sort of builds rapport with the colonists as soon as she arrives. It's very good. But you also get the sense of how frightening it is, which is in the TV story as well, but how frightening it is for her to be on a very unexpectedly on another planet in a different time.
And of course, fast forwarding to the end, I think Hulk also gives her the very last word in the book. So it's really her story more than it is anybody else's, which is nice.
Yeah, it's really good. I think it's good that these sort of quirks exist, isn't it, in Doctor Who, that that just purely based on the order that they wrote the books, that they rewrote the whole character's history, because there is not many attempts at continuity between the target books. You get the odd sort of if there's a reference and the little asterisk and so it says, you know, see Doctor Who and the Abominable Snowman or something, but it is a nice touch with this one.
I think the only attempt is when Ian Martyr was doing Ark in Space and Santarin experiment on TV. It's a transmat device taking the Doctor from Nerva Beacon down to Earth. And at the end of Ark in Space, they go in the TARDIS. And I read that. I'm like, wait a minute. How are they going to tie that into a Santarin experiment? Because they're going to take off in the TARDIS and then arrive by transmat. But Martyr knew what he was doing, so he actually has the TARDIS appear briefly in the Santarin experiment book too.
Oh, right. I don't remember that. That's cool.
But otherwise, yeah, you do get discontinuity between the books because, you know, the books are written out of sequence by different authors, often years or decades apart. So I know when a lot of the Hartnell books come out, you lose one story leading into the next.
Hmm.
Like the Crusade on TV leads into the Space Museum, but in the books they don't match up because, you know, the connection is not there.
Yeah, of course. I suppose a lot of those Hartnell ones are like that, aren't they? Where the costumes carry over, and it's like Keys of Marinus. Ian's still wearing his Marco Polo outfit, I think. Yeah.
Yeah. Yes, with the Chinese lettering. Then, of course, the Daleks ends with this massive explosion leading into the Edge of Destruction, but that is, of course, not in the book because the novelizations were written 25 years apart.
And the Daleks Like This was written as an introduction for Ian and Barbara and Susan as well, wasn't it?
Right. As listeners of this podcast know, I broke that down in some detail in episode 1. Where he didn't have the rights to Unearthly Child, so he had to create a whole new story for Ian and Barbara. So Ian is a frustrated scientist who comes across a car wreck in Barnes Common, and Barbara is a secretary who's been tutoring Susan English, and that's how they meet. So there's no Unearthly Child at all. So moving on with Doomsday Weapon, what struck me about this book is that almost every chapter is a self-contained short story told from a different character's point of view. So with that in mind, which character's POV did you enjoy the most? We've talked about the Time Lord, of course. We've talked about Joe Grant. What other characters do you think had great POV chapters here?
I like the stuff with Norton, the frustrated actor who... Who is doing these awful things, having infiltrated the colonist dome. He then proceeds to kill both one of the natives and one of the engineers, as an electrician. But the whole time what's going through his mind is, well, because he wanted to be an actor since he was a kid, but his parents said, no, you can't be an actor. You need to join one of the big companies. It's the only way you're going to get on and get anywhere in this this dystopian Earth that keeps being described from people's different points of view. But yeah, even while he's sort of stoving people's heads in with spanners, he's thinking to himself, well, I'm just like an actor and this is my prop and I'm waiting for my cue. And it's quite chilling, I think, that he's thinking of it as a performance. But he's murdering people in cold blood. So that really stuck out to me, reading it again.
That's true.
And I think the book as well takes the opportunity to expand everybody's characters. But there's the bit with Ash, isn't there, where we learn that he only brought two books from Earth, which is very short-sighted of him, I think.
That would have lasted me maybe 2 hours on the journey out on the rocket ship, and then I would have been just looking for more.
Yeah, definitely, because they describe the ship's hold as enormous, don't they? Because I know they've brought sort of accommodation and machinery and stuff. And he's only brought two books. And one of them is the Bible, although he doesn't know it's the Bible, does he? He just says it's his old book. And he says it's about a character called God. And he's sort of reading this book and he's puzzling over the idea that somebody would sacrifice themselves for the benefit of others. Like, this is a really alien concept in the future. And of course, even if you didn't know the story, you would then realize that it's quite heavily telegraphed at that point that he's going to end up sacrificing himself for others and kind of understanding the meaning of what is being read.
Which is, you know, fascinating for me because, you know, I'm reading this at 11, 12 years old. I had no exposure to Christianity at that point, and it would be several more years before I read, the parts of the Christian Bible that I've read. So when he starts talking about the same story being told by four different authors, I had no idea what he meant. And it wasn't until I had to read the Christian Bible as literature in high school, so age 14, that I realized, oh, he's talking about the four gospels. I had no idea. Completely lost on me.
And the other sort of odd bit of religion in it is when the two colonists have been murdered and they don't really know what to do. So the doctor sort of takes charge, and it's quite nice because he's quite just sort of like sympathetic, and he's guiding Ash, isn't he? And he says, right, well, we need to do this. And it's not in the TV story, is it? But it's very undoctorly. And he says, well, what religion were they? Really struck me as an odd thing for the doctor to be concerned with. In terms of what manner would they like to be buried? So it made me think it was some kind of preoccupation of Malcolm Hulk's, maybe.
You could spend a lot of time breaking down Hulk's personal politics and beliefs, because famously he was Doctor Who's most, he was literally a practicing communist.
Mm-hmm.
So he's one of Doctor Who's most left-leaning writers ever. I don't imagine that he would have had any religious preference in his own life, but this book, and then later on the last chapter of The Dinosaur Invasion, heavily rely on imagery from the Christian Bible. And in Hulk's worldview, it's interesting because much later on in the novelization of War Games, he establishes that the United States no longer exists, which... I think Zoe was from the year 2000, and from Zoe's perspective, there was no more United States. For Hulk, that's only 30 years in the future, so I don't know what he was thinking, but we're still here, buddy.
Right.
But it's interesting that he doesn't have Earth turn into a communist world state, which I'm sure is what he would have wanted. It's really become this dystopian capitalist nightmare. So the chapter from the point of view of the two colonists who are murdered in the dome by the IMC robot, they talk about how awful life is on Earth. And I love the detail. When they get to this planet, all the colonists do for the first couple of days is walk around with their arms outstretched because there's finally room.
Yeah. Yeah, it reminded me of the Sunmakers, the description of what Earth is like, where, people very rarely get to go out in the open and have sort of fresh air and space and sunlight and things like that. It's a really, really dystopian view, isn't it? Where the Earth is so overcrowded that people just have these tiny rooms. And only if you sort of get on in these companies that do you get like a slightly bigger or a two-bedroom apartment or anything like that. And then for pleasure, they can spend their money either sort of going up kind of onto the surface and getting some sunlight and some air, or these walks where they basically, it sounds like they're on a treadmill. And
right, looking at pictures, and there's a fan blowing fresh air in their face.
Yeah, and sort of like countryside smells are being blown at them and things like that.
Right,
and it's interesting that both that couple, because they decide, right, we need to get out of here. There's a fad for people clubbing together to buy a spaceship to go out and kind of reach a colony world. So they stop doing any of the walks or doing anything pleasurable to save all the money for that. And then that's mirrored with Captain Dent, who is kind of the opposite of them. He just wants to get as far as he can in IMC and work his way up. But he does the same thing in terms of he stops doing any walks, he stops doing anything that's like relaxation or anything like that. But he's just studying and trying to sort of pass his exams to join the company and then progress as quickly as he can. So it's just like the kind of means are the same but trying to go in completely different directions with their lives.
And there's so much emphasis, at least from the IMC characters, about the money and the bonus. And I think there's a line about you've just committed career suicide.
Cardwell, isn't it? That Cardwell insists that Joe isn't killed or is taken out of danger, I think. And the leverage that he's got is the sort of the surveyor. So if he refuses to do it, then they can't go ahead. But yeah, there's a real negotiation there in terms of whether we'll get paid or anything for it. And the IMC thing is that you get from in Dent's backstory is that they choose your wife for you as well.
Oh, right, and his wife has like this crazy dyed hair, which was the style at the time.
Yeah, she's got blue hair. Yeah,
and he seems to have no interest in her whatsoever. No. He'd rather be out in space, far, far from her.
Yeah, it's but they've got two kids and stuff, haven't they? It's weird. But then I suppose you have these TV shows, these reality shows now, don't you? Like Married at First Sight, and maybe Malcolm Hulk was predicting more of the future than we gave him credit for.
Well, the wedding ceremony is there two pieces of paper being stapled together, and a little tinny MIDI fanfare plays.
Yeah.
And that's it. Which obviously would save a lot of money from a traditional 21st century wedding ceremony, but there's not a whole lot of joy there.
No, bits like that are quite Robert Holmes, aren't they, I think, about the sort of bureaucracy of it all and things.
Right, but it's so pronounced in the... Obviously, Holmes only wrote the one book. Hulk just spends a lot of time talking about the details of this dystopian future society. And then you contrast that with the society of the primitives on the planet and the way their civilization devolved. And one of the complaints that I've heard about Colony in Space on TV, I'll just come clean. I love Colony in Space on TV. I think it's tremendously underrated. And I know the current prevailing sentiment about Colony in Space comes from the Discontinuity Guide, the Paul Cornell, etc. book in the mid-90s, where they said it was... You know, like watching socially conscious paint dry. They really hated it. I think it's much better than it's given credit for, but it doesn't have the detail of the book. And I've heard a pretty compelling argument. I don't know if I fully subscribe to it myself, that the TV serial is very colonialist, even though it should be anti-colonial because it's these people trying to get away from a dystopian Earth and trying to get away from the corporation. The way that everyone on TV treats the primitives as mindless savages, and they're left to be destroyed in the end. They're all destroyed in the underground explosion, and nobody even cares. How does the book rectify that, do you think? How does the book do in terms of making the primitives a more fully realized, independent, and more sympathetic culture?
You get they're a little bit psychic, aren't they? So when they're helping around the base, they can anticipate. So the bit where I've forgotten his name, the guy that gets killed, when he needs whatever tools he needs, that they can, that he knows to hand them over, and it gives them a bit more character like that, don't they?
Right, that's right. Then the Doctor is later able to use the powers of hypnosis, I think, to get out of a jail cell with the Master, if memory serves me right.
Yes. Yeah, that's right.
And of course, this is the first novelization, like I said, with the Master in it. What do you think of his introduction here, and how does he come across? I know, obviously, later on, his first proper TV story gets novelized by Terrence Dix, but how does he come across here? Of course, you have the advantage of having that amazing full cover Roger Delgado portrait, which I don't.
Yeah, it's a really great photo of him on the cover. It really, really captures him, I think. I think he's quite true to the TV version, the stuff with the Master, isn't it? It's quite, they capture his sort of suaveness and the way he sort of inveigles himself in and makes everybody think that he is genuinely the adjudicator. Because I think one of the characters later on, even though he's as masquerading as the adjudicator, has ruled against the colonists, somebody says, yeah, but he's a fair and decent man. So you get that sense that he's able to charm his way, even without hypnosis and everything else, he can still get people to trust him to some extent.
It's amazing that you have this great cosmic supervillain, and the very first thing he does is run a fair, competent administrative hearing.
Yeah. I like the bit as well when he's begging the guardian for the weapon, and he sort of really loses his composure for the first time, and then it describes him as being quite embarrassed that he's become so desperate in front of the Doctor. Which ties into the stuff in like the Mind of Evil, isn't it? That his greatest fear is the Doctor's mockery of him.
And then there's the detail of what he does to the real adjudicator, which the Doctor laments the actual fate of the real adjudicator here, like a cast adrift in space or whatever it is. So they work in the Master's cruelty.
Mm.
This is a bit off the boards. Did you notice in the TV serial, whose face do they use for the adjudicator?
I don't know that one.
It's Graham Harper, the production assistant. So they use his face as the photo ident for the real adjudicator when it's looked up on the computers. But Graham Harper, who has a very distinctive face, is then later used as one of the more Brain of Morbius faces.
Right. Oh, I never knew that.
That's, so you can actually do a continuity where it's a pre-Hartnell Doctor, or if you, in my point of view, I still believe they're pre-Morbius Doctor, pre-Brain of Morbius Morbiuses, but I guess now officially, thanks to Chris Chibnall, they're pre-Hartnell Doctors. You could argue that the pre-Hartnell Doctor was masquerading as the adjudicator and is attacked by an old original Master who doesn't know that this is a pre-Hartnell Doctor.
Or an incarnation of the Doctor was inspired by the adjudicator in the way that the 12th Doctor was inspired by Caecilius, is it? Is that how you say it? From
Peter Capaldi and the Fires of Pompeii.
Yeah, maybe he was such a good adjudicator that he inspired an incarnation.
But you have a pre-Hartnell Doctor masquerading as the adjudicator, and then Delgado mistakes him for the real adjudicator and takes his place. So you have two Time Lords both cosplaying as the same minor Earth bureaucrat. It's pretty wild. That's a fun headcanon.
Yeah, and that presumably triggered his regeneration from the Graham Harper incarnation to, maybe the Hinchcliffe incarnation or something.
Yeah, I know in the Obverse books anthology, Forgotten Lives, they have the right order, but I still don't know which one comes first. I think Christopher Barry is the first pre-Hartnell Doctor, and I forget the exact order or sequence after that.
Yeah, I can't remember that either. That's a great fact, though. I didn't realize that was Graham Harper. That's interesting.
I didn't realize that until I was watching it on the Blu-ray, which just came out here in the States less than a year ago, when I was watching it from my pilgrimage is now up to series one. I just watched Father's Day last night. And it's interesting because if Malcolm Hulk is Doctor Who's most fervent communist, Paul Cornell is Doctor Who's most fervent Christian. And Father's Day is more flooded in Christian iconography than any other Doctor Who story, because the church is the only safe place in the world. And then both the Doctor and Pete Tyler have to sacrifice themselves in order for everyone else to be saved. So it's funny that, I mean, I'm just saying this because I watched Father's Day last night for my pilgrimage on Twitter, but it's almost the same ending. But Hulk is doing it in a world where nobody knows what Christianity is, and they're sort of just, you know, going based on long-buried race memories or out-of-context portions of a book, whereas for Cornell, it's almost like his raison d'etre.
Yeah, that crops up quite a bit with Cornell, doesn't it? Because Time Worm Revelation and that Third Doctor Titan comic that he did, Heralds of Destruction, the idea of church as a sanctuary from danger, it crops up quite a few times in his work, doesn't it?
And his John Smith in the book version of Human Nature from the New Adventures actually gets down and says the Christian prayer towards the end of the book when he's trying to hide from the bad guys.
Right. It's been a while since I've read that one.
It would have been a fascinating conversation to have, because both of these guys have a lot of Christian imagery in their work, but one is and the other isn't.
Yeah. I think the other interesting stuff with Malcolm Hulk's background that I was reading recently, he actually spent a lot of time in Cumbria, which is where I live, as an evacuee, basically, during the Second World War. His mum owned a guest house in Cumbria, so he spent quite a lot of time up here. And so I think he said in the Lake District, so it's a kind of big national park area, as opposed to London, where he was born and spent the rest of his time. And I suppose you can see maybe the seeds of, you know, the difference between being on this colony planet where it's all wide open spaces compared to being crushed in a very, very busy city where, you know, there's loads of people and much less space. So, you know, if that sort of thing has maybe influenced him. And then he also, in his young life, found out that he was illegitimate and didn't have a birth certificate, which meant that he didn't have kind of a nationality or residency to stay in the UK, even though he'd never lived anywhere else.
Wow.
And I feel like a lot of the stuff in this book in particular is about being outsiders, because they talk about colonists being kind of outsiders and weirdos, all the sort of IMC people.
All colonists are eccentric. Everyone knows that. I think it's the line.
And I thought, yeah, that you could sort of read that into it a little bit as well, couldn't you? That that everyone else is in this sort of homogenous group, who all wear the same uniform, and then the you know, about people being outsiders and a bit away from the norm, that he would identify with that a little bit.
That's pretty amazing. So you can actually see then seeds of his autobiography. If he'd spent his entire life in London, which even then would have been very, you know, cramped and urban, and then he goes to these wide open spaces, I'm sure the first thing he did was walk around with his arms outstretched like the colonists in the book.
That's it, yeah. So it's quite, I don't know whereabouts in Cumbria it was. I need to maybe do some more research on that. But that's basically part of the world that I live in.
It's pretty fascinating when you delve into the biographies of these great sci-fi writers. You know, obviously here in the U.S., we have the census every 10 years, and it gives you every detail about anybody who registers in a given census. So the census data is not released until 72 years later. So it's kept hidden for 72 years. So in 2012, they released the 1940 census data. So I was able to get a glimpse into my grandparents' life, where they were living in Brooklyn in 1940. You know, my grandmother was 27, my grandfather was 57. But when the census taker comes to the house, my grandmother lies to the census taker and makes my grandfather 10 years younger, so the age difference doesn't seem quite so pronounced. So you can look up this data about Isaac Asimov, for example, the great U.S. sci-fi writer. He's available in the 1925 New York City census, and then the 1930 and the 1940 U.S. census. And I won't say what years or addresses, but there's a point in his life where he was not my grandmother's next door neighbor, but he's living about three or four houses down from her on the same street. And then sometime after that, he's living, obviously decades apart, a few houses down on the same street where I would later live for a time in Brooklyn. So it's fascinating to go back in time and think that, you know, Isaac Asimov lived near my grandmother at the same time and then lived near me decades apart. So it's quite possible that when the appropriate data is out, you'll find out that you and Malcolm Hulk lived in the same address in Cumbria.
No, that's really cool. This is off topic, but I've looked back a little bit like family history through censuses and sort of one branch. I got back to like the 1770s. A few of my ancestors were whitesmiths, which was, I thought, I've never ever heard of that. I've heard of blacksmiths, but there was whitesmiths as well. So blacksmiths worked with sort of iron and heavy metals, and then whitesmiths would work with tin and lighter metals.
I've never heard that word before.
No, it's so weird, isn't it? That like blacksmith is really well known. I had to look it up, and I thought that's like, you know, kind of really learned something there. That quite a few generations were working as whitesmiths in Yorkshire.
It's funny for me because, you know, obviously my last name is Miller, and we actually, on a school field trip in the early 80s, we went to a working mill, and the person who ran the tour asked us, is anyone here of the last name Miller? So of course I raised my hand all excited. Then he goes, you got your last name because one of your ancestors was an actual Miller, you know, in Mother England. I'm like, no, we're Eastern European Jews, and the name was made up at Ellis Island, and we have no idea what we are. And the guy gave me a dirty look. I should have just played along. My last name is literally meaningless, just, you know, randomly assigned or made up. But that's fascinating. You can go all the way back to the 1770s, and it's a job title that's now been forgotten.
Yeah, that was, and I only couldn't go back further because I think that was when they came over from Ireland. And that was as far back as I could find any information.
Yeah, if you're of Eastern European Jewish descent, everybody's paper trail runs out in the 1880s because everything else was destroyed and deliberately purged, so there's nothing left.
Right.
But that takes us a little bit far away from the Doomsday Weapon.
Well, it ties into the themes of these people in the future. They don't remember what the past was like. So all these skills about agriculture and things like that have been lost, haven't they? So the other book that Ash has brought out is like a really, really old book about agriculture because there hasn't been any agriculture for so long. So that's how he's trying to learn how to work the land and things. So,
which is another amazing detail because how many other novelizations take the time to tell you what's in the characters' libraries?
Yeah.
I'm one of those guys that whenever I see somebody being interviewed in front of a bookcase on TV, I pause the tape and I try and see what books are on their shelf.
Definitely, yeah. Yeah, I do the same. But yeah, that detail and then like how the colony works, so in terms of what they eat and how things are powered and all that sort of stuff is quite well thought through. As I said at the start, I think the world building is really, really well done in this book.
And this book is, you know, half again as long as a lot of the later Target books would be. You know, I don't have the Target edition of this one. I know that the Pinnacle edition is 143 pages, but it's very small print with narrow margins. And I have to imagine the Target book goes to about 160 pages.
I will just check. Yeah, 165. That was a close guess.
But the book starts on page 7 probably, so it's probably 159 pages if you...
Yeah, that's true.
Adjust for the actual page count.
And does the Pinnacle edition have the illustrations?
No, they didn't. I've never seen that before. No, that's is that the woman Leeson being killed in the dome?
Yes, it is. Yeah. So it's a picture of a terrified woman, sort of holding her hands up to her face, and but yeah, even that you've got the detail of the dome inside wall. I love the one. I'm a kid as well. I was with
the jumper that Katie Manning wore on TV.
Yeah, the horizontal striped jumper, and you got the Doctor in the TARDIS there. I always loved the ones with illustrations when I was a kid, and now as well. Like often you flick through and find them.
Yeah, so the Pinnacle book, when they bought the rights, they did not port over the illustrations, so the Pinnacle book is picture free. But what we have is the introduction by Harlan Ellison. where he is writing from Los Angeles in the late 1970s and talks about how Doctor Who is better than Star Wars, better than Star Trek. And what's fascinating is when I first got my first Pinnacle book, I was too young to know who Harlan Ellison was. And he's talking about being introduced to Doctor Who by Michael Moorcock. Little did we know that 35 years later, after Ellison writes that introduction, Michael Moorcock will out himself as a major Doctor Who fan and actually writes an 11th Doctor novel all on his own.
Yeah, it's the Terrifiles, isn't it?
The Coming of the Terrifiles, yes. The
Terrifiles, yeah. That was an odd book.
It was.
Yeah, I think that was before I was blogging or before we were podcasting, so we didn't cover that one. But yeah, it was, I remember it being a very strange book.
It was just an odd concept because you have the 11th Doctor and Amy Pond. You know, they're as un-Michael Moorcock, protagonist as you can get. And it was odd seeing him write a book that tied into the established continuity that way.
Mm.
But that just ties in because right here in my copy of The Doomsday Weapon, he's mentioned in the Harlan Ellison introduction as the guy who got Harlan Ellison into the show.
That's great. That's cool.
I'm sure Michael Moorcock has read this novelization. I'd love to know what he thought of it.
Yeah. Yeah, he's not revisited anything since that book. Don't think we've had any more for him. Because there's been a few short story collections and things, but his name hasn't cropped up again yet.
Well, once Matt Smith left the series and the universe started to shrink, I don't imagine they have the budget anymore to afford somebody of Michael Moorcock's caliber.
True.
It's hard to imagine him writing a 12-page short story featuring some one-off TV character.
You never know.
Or it isn't like Lawrence Miles, who wrote a 12-word short story for one of the Decalogues. So I guess my whole thesis behind the Doomsday Weapon book is this is tremendously literary, and it has more detail than you're going to get in a lot of later Target novelizations. You know, it's 159 pages, whereas in a few years, Terrence Tix is writing, barely 100-page books. And then in the 80s, you're going to get authors who barely know how to string together a sentence without making it a run-on. The thought and the care that Malcolm Hulk puts into this book makes it just a great, full-on, proper novel in its own right, not even a novelization, because it's telling its own story. It rewrites the character bios. There's a lot of politics and there's a lot of religion, and you get a lot more of characters' internal thoughts. This is not a he said, she said. There's no omniscient narrator. This is just each individual character, many of whom are villains, telling the story from their own perspective and giving you their own biographies. This is just remarkable. And considering that the book immediately before this was The Silurians, where Hulk is also writing several novels, several chapters from the point of view of the villains, and then he's later on going to give us novelizations like The Green Death and The Sea Devils, we are just lucky that we have him as part of our universe and we have these books, even though Hulk himself, I think, died the year that you were born.
Right. Yeah, I think that's right. Yeah, I think I was reading about that as well. It's 79. It's a shame we didn't get him a bit later on, isn't it? Maybe writing for Tom Baker or been interesting to see his take.
Yeah, or some of the more political McCoy-era stories. It would have been fascinating to see him write a version of The Happiness Patrol, which has a rather rote and mechanical novelization. Mm. But if you give it to someone like Hulk, who's going to rethink everything through and write from the point of view of the various villains, imagine Malcolm Hulk writing Helen Hayes' Thatcher-esque backstory, which the novelization doesn't give us.
Yeah, because I think the interesting thing you get throughout this one, because the sort of the chief kind of baddie is Dent, isn't it? The Captain Dent. And you learn quite early on about he's so rigid, he's just totally bought into the IMC ideology and the rules and everything. And he keeps mentally sort of thinking about things that he's learned on training courses. So when he's trying to deal with Cardwell, he says something like, well, two old friends like us aren't going to fall out over this. And then it says, we learned this on a on like a management course or something.
Right.
So that's I like that touch as well, that he's not just coming out with this stuff. he's thinking back to what he's learned and trying to apply it. And yeah, you're absolutely right. If he was writing for Helen A, it'd be really interesting to get her thought processes and her past, her background story. That'd be amazing.
So we've talked about the way the book is written. We've talked about its politics and its cultural references. What other major differences did you spot from the televised version here within the pages of The Doomsday Weapon?
I can't think of any more, actually. I think the main ones that stuck out to me were the Time Lords, the reintroduction, or the new introduction for Joe meeting the Doctor. Nothing, but it's a little while since I've watched. I haven't watched the TV story since the Blu-ray box set was released here. So, nothing that really leapt out. Is there something really obvious I'm missing?
I think the biggest difference for me is the dialogue. The Hulk kind of he keeps the contours of the TV script, but he sort of jettisons the dialogue and writes his own. So it's much more stylized because obviously he's not trying to shoehorn his stuff into 24-minute segments. So if you look at the last chapter, there's another mass funeral for all the dead. The colonists stood in a circle around the big grave they had dug a little way from the main dome. Most of the IMC men had been safely locked up in their spaceship, ready to be sent back to Earth. But Captain Dent, Caldwell, and three guards were present at the ceremony to bury their own dead. Colonists and IMC guards killed in the final battle were laid side by side in the grave. Gentle rain fell from the clouds, soaking the colonists' poor clothing and making the dusty soil turn into mud. When all the bodies were in the grave, everybody turned to Winton, expecting him now to speak as John Ash had done before. He turned to the Doctor. "You say something," he pleaded. "No," said the Doctor. "It has to come from one of you. This is your land now." I mean, as much as I enjoy the TV story, there is nothing on television that matches the power of that description and those the Doctor's words. It's just not there.
No, absolutely. Yeah, the Doctor throughout this is quite, obviously he's sympathetic towards the colonists compared to IMC, but there's something quite paternal, isn't there? The way he's teaching them all the time, especially Ash. He's a bit of a mentor to him in some times and quite paternal, even though probably the actors are probably about the same age.
Right.
There's this idea that he's going to help push the colony on a little bit and help them sort of rediscover skills that humanity have lost. Because there's a nice conversation he has with Ash at one point, isn't he, where he says, because Ash is a bit pessimistic. And the Doctor says, well, how do you think early man got on? You know, they had to deal with saber-toothed tigers and you know, kind of all these threats. And they just battled through. So, yeah, the nice little kind of motivational thing from the Doctor there.
Yeah, I mean, this is just a lovely book. And I'm thrilled that we have it and that it's still actually in print, thanks to some of the Target re-releases from a few years ago. And hopefully a whole new generation of fans will keep reading this far, far, far into the future. So, Mark, thank you so much for joining me. This is your first of hopefully many appearances on this show, the way that I've appeared now numerous times on the Trap One. But for the rest of my audience, where can we find you online?
Yeah, I'm on Twitter as @QuarkMcMalus. So, like Quark from the Dominators and Malus from The Awakening, but with a muck at the start as MC.
And do you have any other podcast projects going on now that you're transitioning away from the sole host of Trap One?
I'm a regular guest on Maximum Power, which is a Blake 7 podcast where we're going through each of the four series episode by episode with a couple of the other Trap One co-hosts like Cy and Pete, and there'll be other familiar voices, especially if you've heard the Flight Through Entirety Doctor Who podcast. So my role on that is I'm the only one who's never seen Blake 7 before, so I'm watching it as we go through and give my reactions to each story and the ongoing story as it unfolds. So that's a lot of fun as well.
And I think you just reached the end of the very first of four series.
Yep, that's right. I think last weekend the Orak, I think the episode was called. I'm not very good with the episode names for it, but I think, yeah, that one went out. So the same weekend that this podcast drops, there'll be the Series A retrospective episode.
So after you finish listening to this episode, drop everything and listen to Mark on Maximum Power.
Definitely,
and then yeah. Stay tuned for a new Trap One.
Yeah, particularly in the new year, we've got some exciting Trap One podcasts lined up. So yeah, please tune in.
And I look forward to coming back on Trap One as well. And we'll see how I do the next time I have both Simon and Joe on my panel. Good luck to me. Mark, thanks so much for joining us. Hopefully we'll see you soon.
Thank you very much for having me.
Good night now.
Goodbye.
And that was my interview with Mark from the Trap One podcast, a good friend, and very happy to talk to him about Doctor Who and the Doomsday Weapon. That will do it. Thank you very much for joining me on another episode of the Doctor Who Literature Podcast. I'm Jason, your host and editor and producer. This podcast is brought to you by Anchor and can also be found on Spotify and Google Podcasts and hopefully some other platforms going forward. You can find me on Twitter at Doctor Who Novels, that's Dr. Who Novels, and you can also find me on Trap One. I write about Doctor Who on Twitter using the hashtag Doctor Who Pilgrimage, that's Dr. Who Pilgrimage. Please drop me a line with your comments, questions, and suggestions. Next time, we'll be discussing Doctor Who and the Day of the Daleks from 1974, and we'll again be joined by a very special guest from the Target Book universe. Thank you for listening, and keep turning the pages.